Okay, so we've been talking the past few weeks about the Hallel of Leil Seder. Now we're ready to move forward. And I want to start talking today about the mitzvah that we're doing right now. And in fact, was in last week's Parsha. In Chutz Lares, it'll be this week's Parsha. And that is the mitzvah of counting the Omer. Right? There's a mitzvah that every single day, from the second day of Pesach until Shavuos, not including Shavuos, we count the number of days. And this is called the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. The basic idea is a relatively simple idea, and that is you want to connect, you want to link the holiday of freedom, which is Pesach, with the holiday of submission to Hashem, which is Matan Torah, to teach us the basic idea that freedom that is not connected to Torah is ultimately very destructive. And in fact, the Ramban even says that one way of conceptualizing Sfiras HaOmer is it is a Chol HaMoed. Pesach and Shavuos are in fact one holiday. One holiday. And the Omer period is Chol HaMoed. Now you gotta be careful if you tell your boss you don't work during Chol HaMoed and you don't show up for 7 weeks, you might get in trouble. But the Ramban actually says that it's Chol HaMoed. Chazal make the point in a number of ways. One way they describe it is that the korban of grain that is brought on Pesach is Omer, which is barley, and the grain offering that is brought on Shavuos is wheat. Barley was typically fed to animals. This is before the invention of cholent. Wheat is eaten by human beings, and therefore Pesach before Shavuos is simply animal freedom. Shavuos turns it into human dignity. Right? That's the simple meaning of the counting of the Omer. But let's go back. So first of all, let's go back to the lashon of the pasuk itself in Parshas Emor, last week's parsha. Usvartem lachem mimacharas hashabbos. You shall start counting. I'm going to translate it literally from the day after Shabbos. Miyom haviachem es Omer hatnufa, from the day that you bring the Omer offering. Now, just in terms of translation, the word Omer is nothing more than a volume. It's like saying a bushel. And the amount of flour that is brought for the Omer offering is the volume, it's the same volume that Chayev and Challah. It's the volume of 43 and the fifth eggs. And how that translates, 2.5 pounds, 5 pounds, whatever it would be. So imagine you took the amount of flour, barley flour, that you'd have to take challah from today. It's mixed with oil. The kohen takes 3 fingers of the flour off. This is called kamitza. That is burnt on the mizbeach. The rest of the flour is baked into barley cakes that, of course, have to be matzah, not chametz. And it is consumed by Kohanim. That's a Korban Mincha. That's called Minchas HaOmer. And Omer is nothing more than the size of that volume. So Omer is actually important for 3 different measurements, although they're related. Number one, it was the amount of barley flour that was brought as a Mincha the second day of Pesach. Number two, it is the amount of any flour which becomes obligated in Challah. Less than the sheer Omer is not chayav in challah. And number 3, Omer is the amount of man that fell every day per person in the midbar. So it is the shiur of the man, it is the shiur of the korban Omer, it is the shiur of challah. Now, I don't want to get into the halachas of challah now, maybe some other week we'll discuss it. I just want to point out that the shiur of challah is a volume measure. It is not a weight measure. It is the volume that would be taken up by 43 and a fifth egg. Now, you may be a little confused, so why do we talk about 2.5 pounds of flour, 5 pounds of flour? Challah is not based on weight at all. It is based on volume. And the short answer is that we're simply using weight as a conversion factor, meaning this amount of flour will typically have that amount of volume, because weight is an easier measure. But in reality, The more accurate way of measuring challah is by cups of flour, because cups are a volume measurement. Weight is a little misleading. So it is actually better to talk about cups, and there's a lot of uncertainties. It's between 8 and 16 cups of flour. And that's why we say from 8 and up, you separate challah without a bracha, because it's a doubt. Once it's 16 cups, it's with a bracha. But be it as it may, all shiurim in eating are volume measures, kazayas, right? You have to eat the volume of an olive, the volume of an egg. So conversion tables may express it in terms of weight, but in point of fact, it is a volume measurement. Okay, but be it as it may, the Torah says you shall start counting this period of time the day after Shabbos, from the day that you bring the Omer offering. Now, what does it mean the day after Shabbos? The day after Shabbos is Sunday, of course. What does that mean? So here, the Mishnah and the Gemara in Menachos gives us a huge, long machlokas that spanned hundreds of years between the Tzedukim and the Purushim. The Tzedukim are the Sadducees, the Purushim are the Pharisees. And if you got your education from the New Testament, you might be a little misled, because in the Christian, I shouldn't call it the New Testament, but the Christian Bible, the Pharisees are the bad guys. But in our tradition, the Prushim, the Pharisees, are Chazal. our Tanoim are the Pharisees. Now, the Tzedukim were a movement that was founded by a man called Tzedok. Mm-hmm. And the Tzedukim essentially did not accept the Torah Sheba'al Peh. They did not accept the written, the oral interpretation of the Torah. They did not accept the authority of Chazal. They only looked at the Torah Shebichsav. They were called the Tzedukim. Now, don't confuse the Tzedukim with the Karaim. They are very, very similar in ideology, but they are two different movements. The Tzedukim was a movement during the Second Temple period, before the Mishnah. And by the time of the Roman destruction of the Beis HaMikdash in the year 70, the Tzedukim were extinct. Now, how they got extinct is not entirely clear, kind of like the dinosaurs with the meteor shower, or they just seem to have disappeared. Right? No Tzedukim. Now, the Karaim, you might look at essentially as a resurrection of the Tzedukim, but that occurred even after the Gemara. That occurred in the 11th century, in the time of the Gaonim, in the time of Rav Sadia Gaon. And it's interesting how it got invented. I mean, you'd figure religious ideologies ought to be created by religious motivations, one would think. But in point of fact, the whole religion of Karaitism was simply created by a guy who didn't get a job that he wanted. There was a fellow, Anan ben David, who must have been a fairly qualified Talmud Chacham. He was in line to get the position as Gaon of Sura. Sura was the main yeshiva in Babel, and the Gaon of Sura was considered to be the leader of the Jewish people. And Anan ben David didn't get the job. Instead, the job went to Rav Sadia Gaon. So Anan ben David was very upset. So he decided to break away from the authority of the Gaonim of Babel, which essentially meant rejecting the oral law. And he founded his own movement, which was called Karaim, the Karaim. Now, Karaim comes from Mikra, which is Tanakh. And they, too, emphasized only the written Torah. So they're
are
not...
Those the Karaites?
Those are the Karaites today. And they are still around even today, albeit in small number. So ideologically, they are connected to the Tzedukim, but they are two different movements. The Tzedukim were extinct several hundred years before the... In fact, almost 1,000 years before the Karaim came on the scene. But there is a Tzad HaShoveh, there is a common denominator that both of them emphasize the written Torah over the oral Torah. They would call, and now what's interesting is the Karaites do still exist. There's even a chief rabbi of the Karaites, etc., here in Yerushalayim. And they're not like Reform. I mean, they are sincerely religious people based on their religious beliefs. So to give you an interesting example of how they work, if you walked into a Karaite synagogue, you will see people wearing a talis. They will be wearing tzitzis, because tzitzis is in the Torah. Mm-hmm. It is in the book of Bamidbar, and of course they'll also have tchelet. because since they don't accept all the rabbinic traditions, they don't need to identify a specific source for Tehillah. Tehillah means blue, so they can use blue paint. They can use whatever they can use a magic marker. So the Tehillah of a Karaite is not the Tehillah from the Murex or whatever it is. It's maybe it is. I mean, they wouldn't possible that, but it could be anything. However, Karaites do not wear tefillin. Tefillin is not worn by a Karaite man. And the reason is because even though the Torah says you shall tie it upon your hand and put it between your head, interestingly enough, the Karaites give that a metaphorical interpretation, that the words of Torah, actually, the truth is the metaphor is correct, but we also believe it's literal. They say it means the Torah should be your strength, should be carried out by your arms, and it should always be in your mind. And therefore, they do not believe that there's a commandment of physical tefillin, and they say that that was an invention by the rabbinites, as they call our chazal.
What about mezuzot?
Mezuzot they have.
What about what's in the mezuzot?
Well, they do have the Shema. They don't, because after all, I mean, when the Torah says you shall write it, it's in the two parshiyos of Shema and V'hayah im Shemoah.
And how do they angle the mezuzah?
You know, that I don't know. I'd have to see. I'd have to check. I'm not a big expert in Karaites. Now, over the years, there's been a lot of discussion. I mean, obviously, Karaites do not believe in the oral law, so religiously, they're not keeping the Torah properly. The question is, are they halachically Jewish?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Meaning, was there an issue of intermarriage, etc.? So it depends. In some communities, Karaites were treated as non-Jews, quite literally. They were not allowed to marry, etc. Rav Avi Yosef, Zichrono Livracha, who was a rabbi in Egypt for a few years. He was born in Eretz Yisrael, but then he went to Mitzrayim, and then he came back to Eretz Yisrael. But in Mitzrayim, there had been historically a very large Karaite community. I'm not sure if they're still around today. And he said he had a lot of contact with them. And he said 100% they were halachic. I mean, again, their beliefs are heretical beliefs. We're not validating their beliefs. But he said the 100% they were halachically Jewish.
They didn't intermarry over all
they
those
did not intermarry
well.
Over. But he said that that was limited to that particular community, and it wasn't necessarily a generalization. Every once in a while, Karaites do walk into a shul, whatever. I mean, listen, somebody told me Bet Tefillah in Baltimore. The problem is, just like a Sephardi may have to daven in an Ashkenazi shul because there isn't a Sephardi minyan, so Nebuch, Karaites sometimes have to daven in a regular shul because there isn't a Karaite minyan. So every once in a while you'll have a Karaite who will come to a Beit Knesset. In fact, I had gotten a shaila that his son was going to be bar mitzvah. He wanted to make his... although I didn't know the Karaites have bar mitzvahs, but apparently they do have some bar mitzvah celebration, and the question is, would the shul be allowed to make a bar mitzvah for a Karaite? What form would it take, you know, etc. So you will encounter it even today.
Are they counted in a minyan if they're heretical?
They would not be counted for a minyan. But again, you know, we don't ask questions. I mean, people walk in off the street, you know, we don't, are you a Karaite? We tend not to ask those types of questions. But Karaites are still around. Now, interesting point about Karaim, this is a little digression, but you'll see why this is very relevant to the counting of the Omer in a moment. Because Karaites did not accept the Gemara, the Mishnah and the Gemara, they did become very, very expert in Tanakh, because their field was grammar, diktuk, philology, language. And as a result, we do find some of our Mephorshim would sometimes turn to Karaim, not for ideology, but for interpretation of words and the like. So, for example, the Ibn Ezra, the Abar Ben El, will sometimes bring Karaite interpretations of verses if they don't contradict the halacha. In fact, one of the most important works refuting Christianity, you know, a lot of Christianity, like Christian missionaries, like to prove from various biblical verses, particularly Sefer Yeshayahu, chapter 53, other chapters, they want to prove that the prophet is talking about Yashka, talking about Jesus, etc. And either that is intentional distortion or unintentional, but whatever it is. So we have various books that try to show us what the Jewish interpretation of these verses are, to refute the claims of missionaries. The Radak did it, the Ramban did it in his famous debate in Barcelona. But one of the best books and most complete books about refuting the Christian claims based on Tanakh was a book called Chizuk Emunah, The Strengthening of Faith, and it was written by a Karaite. And this is actually used even today by religious Jews who are anti-missionary work, because even though he's a Karaite, the book is not about being a Karaite. The book is about interpreting the biblical verses in Yeshayahu so that we understand it's not referring to Yashka or whatever it is. So the Karaim did have a specialty. They did have a certain field in which they excelled. And our Chachamim were sometimes willing to even use Karaite interpretations. Not only that, but to take even a bigger extreme, sometimes they even used Christian interpretations. Not the Messianic ones, obviously, but you know, sometimes. The apostles and the church fathers, which was the later generation, they certainly knew Hebrew. Many of them might have been born Jewish. In either case, they lived in the Middle East, they lived in Israel, they lived in Syria. So their languages were Hebrew, Aramaic, Syriac, these different types of languages. And sometimes they offered interpretations of Tanakh that our Meforshim were able to accept. They tell a story, I suspect it's not a true story, but I'll tell the story. They tell the story that Rav Haigon, who was the greatest of the Gaonim, the last of the Gaonim, the greatest of the Gaonim, his yeshiva was right across the street from a monastery. Apparently there was a Christian monastery in Bavel, I'm not sure why there'd be a monastery there, and he was learning Nach with his Talmidim. It's interesting, he was learning Nach, it wasn't Gemara. And at some point there was a word that was very difficult to translate. So he told one of his students, go across the street and ask them how they understand it. So the student didn't understand what was being said to him. He just stared and his mouth was agape and And Rav Haigon said, what's the matter? You think they can't give you some interpretation? Chazal say, our sages say, Chachma b'goyim tamin, there is wisdom even among the goyim. You can learn from goyim too. And the Rambam quotes the famous saying, Kabeh ho'emes mimi sha'amra, accept the truth from whomever you get it. Again, I have a feeling that this story, as it were, probably didn't happen. This is my gut reaction. I think in the Middle Ages there was a tendency, I just hate to say it, that whenever you wanted to make a point, you made up a story to support your point. So somebody said, you have to be Makabel Emes, which is a good point. Then you make up a story. And in the Middle Ages, I mean, even among Sfarim that are very chashuv, there was less of a reluctance, because the point was, if you're making a true point, who cares if the story is true or false? It was that idea that I'm making a good point, so I'll make up a story to support the point.
My father, Oliver Shalom, used to say, all my stories are true, but some of them haven't happened yet.
Some haven't happened yet. That's correct. But it is true. It is true that in the Abarbanel, the Abarbanel does sometimes quote Christian interpretations, often to refute them, but sometimes to support them in terms of
what do they
language.
Call it? I mean, they call it by their
name. They'll say Chachmei HaNotzchim. Yeah, they'll say such a lashon. Karaim, Notzchim, whatever it would be. Now, I think they say, I don't remember the whole story, I heard this from tour guide many, many years ago, that there is a Karaite synagogue in Yerushalayim, more than one, but in one of them there was like a curse that they'll never have a minion. So it turns out, like, you know, whenever they are up to 10 people, like somebody dies, like there's never like a minion. They're always like 9, and then somebody comes in, and then somebody leaves. And, you know, so it's considered to be a curse that's still active. But on the other hand, I do know there is a chief rabbi, Karaite chief rabbi, so there must be another Karaite synagogue. Maybe it's not Yerushalayim, I don't know. Okay.
Do they all live in Israel then, for the most part?
No. As I say, there were many Karaites in Egypt, and there are there are some in the United States. Now, they have a website. Maybe I shouldn't give you that information. If you want to check it out, go to the website, and you can see all the Karaite minhagim and everything else. Meaning, it's kind of strange. They are actually very devout. I mean, religiously, they are kind of small c conservative, meaning they're very strict in the halachos or laws that they keep. They're not like looking for easy ways out. Some of their laws are very tough, but nevertheless, halachically, they are not keeping an authentic Judaism and the like.
Do they consider themselves Jews?
Absolutely.
Okay, and Jews, they consider
us Jews. It's very, very nice of them. But they consider themselves to have the authentic. Now, the question is, I've never had a discussion with a Karaite. The question is, how could they believe it? I mean, we know when Karaiteism got invented. I mean, it got invented. It got invented after the Gemara, right? So it's a little difficult to say, oh, that the Gemara was a made-up thing when Karaiteism came after the Gemara, because a guy didn't get his job. Anan ben David didn't get his job, but okay. So I remember I was once wandering around in the Harvard University Library. And the Harvard University Library has one of the world's greatest collections of Sfarim. Amazing. The Library of Congress. And I think to myself sometimes, you know, the Gemara says, everything needs mazel, even a Sefer Torah. And I think to myself, you know, some Gemaras find their way to yeshivas and Beis Medrash, and they're constantly learned and constantly used. And other Gemaras are in university libraries that maybe in a thousand years, you know, one person might pull it out. You know, I almost feel sorry for the Sefer. Yeah, it's in a beautiful library, you know, maybe a better condition than a yeshiva, but, you know, how much more would the Sefer want to be in a place where people are learning it all the time? But Harvard University does have one of the world's greatest collections of Sfarim, rare Sfarim, all sorts of things, like the National Library here, Library of Congress, Harvard University, there are three, JTS, are the Hebrew Union, five. There are five big Judaica libraries in the world that are considered to be dominant. So as I was walking around, I noticed a whole section on Karaite literature. So I came across the Karaite Siddur, which I guess you probably even get online. So I was wondering, what would a Karaite Siddur have? Like, what would it be? So keep in mind, it doesn't have Shemona Esrei. It doesn't have the blessings before Shema or after Shema. It doesn't have the morning blessings. It doesn't have the blessings over the Torah, because all of those are creations of the Chachamim. They do have the psalms of Psukei Dezimra. They do have the Shema. And they have prayers of their own composition, which is interesting. So when people reject the Torah Shebaal Peh, that doesn't mean they just go with Tanakh. It means they create their own version of things. So there is a Karaite equivalent to Shemona Esrei, but it's just not ours, right? It's a different one.
Is it true that they will sit in the dark on Shabbos because they don't believe?
Yeah, so that was true of the Sadukim in the time of the Second Temple. That's not true of the modern Karaites today.
How do we get around it?
Well, you know, there's reform elements in Karaiteism as well, you know. But of course, you know, B'nai Brak has the same sheet, the Chaz Nish has the same sheet. You're not allowed to use electricity. Well, that's a different reason. The Chaz Nish's famous Shita was that in the state of Israel, you are not allowed to use electricity on Shabbos because it's generated by Jewish people who are desecrating Shabbos. So in B'nai Brak, you have to have your own generator, or don't have lights. You cannot use municipal or national generated electricity in Israel because you're benefiting from the Shabbos desecration of Jewish workers. That's the Chazon Ish Shita. Interestingly enough, this Shita is spreading and spreading and spreading. Those of you that have Haredi children, grandchildren, might be seeing this. What started the Minhag of Yerushalayim always was to be lenient on it. Near yeshiva, you know. But lately, since Rav Chaim Kineski became more and more, Tzatzal became more and more Mekubal as Gadol Hador, you may notice a lot of B'nai Brak practices spread to Yerushalayim and really throughout Eretz Yisrael. And as a result, you'll find more and more Avreichim are investing in generators for Shabbos. It costs a lot of money, so they have to, you know, so a building gets together or a few buildings get together to buy generators, not to benefit from municipal or whatever, national electricity on Shabbos. But this was the famous psak of the Chazon Ish, and initially it was only kept by a small group of people, but now it's more and more accepted. Now still, as far as I know, I mean, most yeshivos and most charedim even, they turn on before Shabbos or Shabbos clock. They don't turn on Shabbos, but they use it. But more and more people, and in fact, I get a shout all the time. We don't have a lot of money. I'm asking me, should they spend this lot of money to invest in generators, or is it not that important to them to do so? It's a different issue. The Chazon Ish used to say about this, again, this is not our topic, that he felt that anybody who uses electricity that is produced by Mechal of Shabbos, even apart from the halacha, it's a tremendous chilul Hashem, because the person is showing they don't really care. He gave an example. Imagine, this is a very striking example. Imagine it's the 9th of Av, 2,000 years ago, the year 70, and you're walking by a burning Beis HaMikdash, and you have a cigarette, in your mouth. So you figure, well, listen, there's a fire here anyway, so you light your cigarette by the burning of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, halachically, are you allowed to do it? We can discuss it. Halachically, maybe you're allowed to do it. He says, but what type of Jewish heart is going to light his cigarette from the burning of the Beis HaMikdash? It's a very striking muscle. So the Chazon Ish says, a Jew is desecrating Shabbos. A Jew is, maybe it's not his fault, maybe he's a Tinok Shenishbay, we're not blaming anybody, but this is such a sin and such a tragedy that Shabbos is being desecrated and violated in a public way. And you're sitting back and enjoying your cholent or enjoying your reading by the light that is produced. So the Chazon Ish says, how could a Jewish soul, how could a Yiddish neshama benefit from the chilul Shabbos of other Jews? That was the Chazon Ish. Yeah.
Well, don't they have Arabs who work there and other people? How do you know that?
How do you know? Okay, the truth
and
is...
And everybody who says he's Jewish... May not be. His mother was converted, but not properly, he's really not Jewish.
Yeah, you don't know, but the truth is, when all is said and done, the majority of workers still happen to be Jewish. Now, the issue is, these generating systems are largely automated anyway. They are automated. So it's not like you have a guy that's constantly pushing, all the buttons all over the place. But there is a lot of manual input in adjusting things, correcting things. By the way, speaking about not being Jewish, you heard the story now about the guy who got married as a Jew, and then they discovered he was a Muslim. But now he came back to Israel. He wants to sincerely pursue conversion in order to go back to his wife. Of course, the problem is his wife is of the Syrian community, and the Syrian Jews don't accept converts. So even if he gets a valid gerus, his wife would have to leave her community, which she may not want to do. But it's a real mess. But the guy sounds very sincere. He says, I want to be Jewish. I want to keep the mitzvahs. I jumped the gun a little bit when I got married before the conversion.
Is he Israeli?
Was he an Israeli citizen? I don't remember the details. But he was a guy who passed himself off as a yeshiva person. He married a frum woman, and it turned out he was a Lebanese Arab. So that was a real tragedy, but he seems to be kind of crazy. He seems to be a sincere person who's kind of said, I made a mistake, but I want to be Jewish and I want to be married to this woman, So now he's in Eretz Israel, and now he's in some course for Gior. And Bezras Hashem, I hope, I think should be Bahatzlacha and the like. Okay, so all of this was a big, big digression, but why am I bringing this up? Because one of the main controversies between the Prushim and the Tzdukim, and this remains a controversy between, let's say, Orthodox Judaism and Karaites, is what is the meaning of the phrase Mimacharat HaShabbos? When do you start counting the Omer? And that's very important, because when you start counting the Omer will also determine when Shavuos is. Because Shavuos is day 50 of your Omer count. the Karaim, as the Tzdukim did much earlier, say that Shabbos is very literal. Shabbos means Saturday. Mimacharas HaShabbos is Sunday. That means the counting of the Omer starts the Sunday after Pesach, meaning after the first day of Pesach. Now, this year, remember John F. Kennedy's famous statement in Berlin, we're all Berliners. I don't want to say we're all Karaites. This year we're all Karaites because we and the Karaites are starting the same time. Because this year, because the first Seder was Friday night, so the counting of the Omer began Saturday night, Sunday. The Karaim begin at the same time. So this year there's Achdus. When there's Achdus, that's always good. Right. But normally when Pesach is not, when the Seder is not Friday night, we would start earlier. They would start the first Sunday after Pesach. Because they say that Shabbos is literal, and Macharas HaShabbos is Sunday. We say Shabbos does not mean Saturday, but Shabbos means the Yom Tov of Pesach, the first day of Pesach, which is also called Shabbos because Shavisa, anything that has a restriction from Malacha, is called Shabbos. We'll talk shortly, why does the Torah use such an unusual phrase for the first day of Pesach. Now you see from the Gemara in Menachos that the Tzdukim's position was very, very popular. Many, many people, many Jews were following the Tzdukim's position, and the Chachamim had to go to great lengths to refute it by various arguments. It's been suggested, in fact the Gemara even implies such, that part of why the Tzdukim's position was so popular, this is very interesting, is because it gave everybody a two-day holiday vacation. Now remember, in Eretz Yisrael, I mean, even today, but even in the ancient times, Sunday was never a day off, right? The only day off you had in Eretz Yisrael was Shabbos, that was it. And you didn't have 2 days of Yom Tov, right? So in a sense, whenever you had a Yom Tov on a Friday or a Sunday, that was kind of special. That gave people a two-day vacation. So according to the Karaim's count, if the counting of the Omer begins on Sunday, that means Shavuos, day 50, is always going to be on Sunday. So you always had a Shabbos followed by a Shavuos, like this year. And therefore it was very popular because it guaranteed a two-day vacation. Masha'enkein, like the Prushim, Shavuos would be a one-day, and it wasn't necessarily going to be the same as, adjacent to a Shabbos or whatever it would be. So the Chachamim did go to great lengths to disprove this idea, but the Tzdukim kept this as their position, and the Karaites to this day will count Shavuos from the Sunday after the first day of Pesach, and this year, as they say, our count is going to be the same as theirs, and the like. Okay. So the question I want to explore, which is a little bit b'derech drush, is why does the Torah call the first day of Pesach Shabbos? So the Ibn Ezra gives a partial answer. He says, well, what else could the Torah say? What about, instead of Mimacharas HaShabbos, say Mimacharas HaPesach, you shall start counting from the day after Pesach, the holiday of Pesach, which is the first day. That would be better. So the Ibn Ezra points out that would not have been better, that would be worse, and here's the reason. There is in the Torah a day that's called Chag HaPesach. But when the Torah talks about Pesach, what day is it referring to? So actually, you have to see, the Torah uses two different Lashonos. When the Torah refers to the 15th of Nisan, it calls it Chag HaMatzos, the holiday of Matzah. But when it refers to Pesach, it does not refer to the 15th of Nisan. It refers to the 14th of Nisan, Erev Pesach. Why would the 14th of Nisan be called Pesach? Because that is the day you bring the Korban Pesach. And in fact, you can prove this from the Torah itself. The Torah says in Parshas Masai, Mimacharas HaPesach Yatsu B'nai Yisrael. B'nai Yisrael left Mitzrayim the day after Pesach. Now wait a second. What do you mean they left the day after Pesach? They left on Pesach. They left on the 15th of Nisan. That's why we celebrate Pesach. The answer is, you see klar from that pasuk, that the day of Pesach is the 14th, Mimacharas HaPesach is the 15th, and that's called, a holiday called Chag HaMatzos. So, says the Eben Ezra Pasha, if the Torah would have said, you shall start counting Mimacharas HaPesach, we would have started counting the Omer the 15th of Nisan. Not the 16th, the day after Pesach. Therefore, the Torah had to say the day after Shabbos, Shabbos meaning a day you can't do work. And that's only the 15th you can't do it, the 14th you could. So the Eben Ezra says, it has to say Mimacharas HaShabbos, because if it would say Mimacharas HaPesach, I would start counting the Omer from the 15th of Nisan. Mimacharas HaShabbos pushes me to the 16th of Nisan. But that's a partial answer, because that does answer why the Torah could not have said Mimacharas HaPesach. But Mimacharas HaShabbos is also ambiguous, because Mimacharas HaShabbos could mean like the Tzedukim. So if the Torah really wanted to eliminate ambiguity, there's a very simple way of doing it. Let the Torah give you a date. Let the Torah say, Biyom Shisha Asar Lachodesh Harishon, on the 16th day of the first month, that's always Nisan, you count the Omer. No ambiguity. Why use Shabbos? Why use Pesach? Why use any of those things? Just say the date. Okay? So the Eben Ezra doesn't answer that. The Eben Ezra just answers why Mimacharas HaShabbos is better than Macharas HaPesach. Okay, but skip the whole thing. So let me share with you a beautiful machshava from the Or Sameach in his book on Chumash, the Meshech Chachma, Reb Meir Simcha HaKohen of Dvinsk. And let's start off with an idea that when we compare Shabbos and Yom Tov, there are two differences halachically between Shabbos and Yom Tov. Difference number one is the heter that is called Ochel Nefesh. Ochel nefesh is a heter for preparation of food or other Yom Tov needs. Shabbos, there is no heter to do malacha for food preparation. The only heter on Shabbos is pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh is a matter of life and death. But ochel nefesh, I mean, if you state that I can't cook on Shabbos because I want some food or whatever it would be. Yom Tov, on the other hand, even though there is an Isra of Malacha, I'm not allowed to do Malachos on Yom Tov, but the Malachos are going to be mutter if they are for the preparation of food. You can cook on Yom Tov, you can carry things on Yom Tov, and the like. So difference number one is Yom Tov has a heter of Ochel Nefesh, and Shabbos does not have a heter of Ochel Nefesh. There is difference number two between Yom Tov and Shabbos, and that is, what determines the sanctity of the day? The sanctity of Shabbos is automatic, meaning every seventh day is going to be Shabbos, whether you know it or not, whether Jews are observing Shabbos, even if, God forbid, there would be no Jew in the world keeping Shabbos. Although the Or HaChaim actually says, if no Jew would keep Shabbos, the world would just destroy itself. We're putting the Or HaChaim aside. Even if there's no Jew in the world keeping Shabbos, Shabbos is intrinsically holy. It is the day of God. Yom Tov is very different. Yom Tov depends on a Sanhedrin that sanctifies the new moon. Because Yom Tov is defined as X number of days from the day that the Sanhedrin proclaimed was Rosh Chodesh. So Pesach is 15 days from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Sukkos is 15 days. Yom Kippur is 10 days. Rosh Hashanah happens to be the day of Rosh Chodesh. And the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah makes clear that even if astronomically the Sanhedrin proclaimed the wrong day as Rosh Chodesh, the holidays are counted from their proclamation date rather than the astronomical reality. In other words, it is the Sanhedrin acting as agent of the Jewish people that sanctifies Rosh Chodesh, that enables the holidays to exist. Now, you'll ask the obvious question. Today, there is no Sanhedrin. Today, there is no Kiddush HaChodesh, no sanctification of the new moon. So why are there holidays at all? So there are a few different answers, but the Ramban actually says the only reason we have Yomim Tovim today is not because we have a calendar, but because the last Sanhedrin that made this calendar computed all of the Rosh Chodesh in advance and declared them to be sacred on those. I don't have a clear picture of how this looked, but imagine that they had this calendar. They extrapolated all the Rosh Chodesh days until the year 6000. I'll get to that in a moment. And then, I don't know how long it took, they sit as a body and they say, okay, Monday, whatever it would be, and in this particular year, we hereby sanctify, right? And they just declared thousands and thousands of days as Rosh Chodesh, and that is the only reason why we have Yomim Tovim. This is the meaning of the oft-repeated statement that the Jewish calendar expires in the year 6000. Now, in truth, that doesn't make sense because the calculations of the Jewish calendar can be extended indefinitely. Based on the formulas of the Jewish calendar, I could tell you what day Pesach would be 10,000 years from now. I can tell you what day Pesach will be in a million years. I don't know, it'll take a while to figure out. In other words, what do you mean the calendar expires? The calendar has a repetitive pattern. The answer is, yeah, we could figure out the date, but the Sanhedrin only sanctified the Rosh Chodesh until the year 6000, based on the idea that we have a Masorah, that Moshiach for sure will come no later than the year 6000, and at that point we'll have a Sanhedrin, and we'll go back to the old system. Now, what that means is a mind-blowing proposition. If counterfactually, Moshiach would not come by the year 6000, the observance of Yomim Tovim would stop. There would be no Rosh Hashanah, there would be no Yom Kippur, there would be no Sukkot, there would be no Pesach, there would be no Shavuos, because there is no sanctification of a Rosh Chodesh. And without the sanctification of a... In other words, Pesach is 15 days from a sanctified Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Rosh Hashanah is the day of a sanctified Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. Without a Kiddush HaChodesh, there is no Yomim Tovim. Now, Shabbos is very different. Shabbos does not depend on any action we do. This is why the Nusach of the Bracha of Shabbos is Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbos. Blessed art you, Hashem. You, Hashem, sanctify Shabbos. When I recite Kiddush, the word Kiddush means sanctification. It's not that I'm sanctifying Shabbos. I'm acknowledging that Hashem sanctifies Shabbos. When it comes to Yom Tov, Mekadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim, Hashem sanctifies Am Yisrael, which is then empowered through their Sanhedrin to sanctify time. And that is why when it's Shabbos and Yom Tov together, the Nusach is very meduyak, very exact. Baruch atah Hashem, Mekadesh HaShabbos, V'Yisrael, V'Azmanim. You don't say Mekadesh Yisrael, V'Shabbos, V'Azmanim, because it's two different things. The holiness of Shabbos comes from God. The holiness of Yom Tov comes from us. So the kitzer, these are two chilukim, two distinctions between the holiness of Shabbos and the holiness of Yom Tov. And that is, one is ochel nefesh, and the other is kedushat hazman, who determines the sanctity of time. Did you want to say?
I had a question about the Sanhedrin, and I assume there have been some movements to reestablish it.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Very, very interesting story in and of itself. Let's first ask in a basic halachic standard. Why don't we have a Sanhedrin? Okay. What stops us from having a Sanhedrin at all? So the short answer is one word, and that's smicha. I hate to say it, but all of us rabbis who claim to have smicha, we are all fraudulent. True smicha, which means ordination, is an unbroken chain, even of laying of the hands, going all the way back from Moshe Rabbeinu. Smicha, an unbroken chain. And that confers great authority, spiritual authority. And to create a Sanhedrin, you have to have the institution of smicha. Now the problem was, at some point in Roman times, the last people who had smicha were murdered before they were able to ordain their disciples. So as a result, smicha got discontinued. And when smicha gets discontinued, we no longer have the power to have a Sanhedrin. Now, in the 1500s in Tzfat, Rav Yaakov Beirab, who was the Rebbe of Rav Yosef Karo, he was actually a very chashuv person, felt, based on a Rambam, that you could create smicha out of whole cloth if all of the sages of Israel get together in one group and they decide they want to reinitiate ordination, they could create it in spite of not having an unbroken chain. And Rav Yaakov Beirav was pushing very, very hard to reinstitute smicha because he thought this would bring Mashiach, etc. And he actually did ordain with official smicha. He ordained four of his talmidim, Rav Yosef Karo, actually got ordained in that way, Rav Moshe Alshich, Rav Moshe Galante, who's less known, but he must have been a great person, and the Mabit, Rav Moshe, three Moshes and one Yosef. What happened was that he was in Tzfat. The Chachmei Yerushalayim never agreed to this proposal. They said it was forbidden. So after one generation, it never got carried out. But this was an aborted attempt to try to create a Sanhedrin. In more recent times, there actually is a body, even a website, in Yerushalayim today called the Sanhedrin. And the head of it, before he was Nifter, was Rabbi Steinsaltz, was head of the Sanhedrin.
Rabbi
Steinsaltz. Adin Steinsaltz, or Eben Yisrael, as he knew it towards the end of his life. But Rabbi Steinsaltz himself would be the first to, I mean, he said it many, many times, this is not a real Sanhedrin, this is just kind of a chinuch, this is like to prepare ourselves, to kind of get used to the idea. But he himself absolutely said it was not a Sanhedrin, although some people treated it like a Sanhedrin. Within the mainstream Haredi world, that group was totally ignored. It was simply, nobody paid any attention to it whatsoever. So again, so ultimately, at the bottom line is, we are left with the halachic issue that lacking smicha, we cannot have a Sanhedrin. So the question becomes, how will smicha be recreated? And the answer is, Eliyahu HaNavi will be the one that brings smicha back into the world. Eliyahu HaNavi had smicha, and when he comes, he will ordain the elders that are worthy of that particular title. Now, what we call smicha today, which is, rabbinic ordination, it's a borrowed term. Technically, it is not smicha. The accurate, I use the term, everyone uses the term, but the accurate term is heter hora'ah. Heter hora'ah simply means you're given permission by your teachers to paskin questions of Jewish law. So it's not smicha. You could not be on the Sanhedrin because you got smicha from Neri Israel or YU or whatever it would be. But it's a heter. It's really a diploma, more or less. It kind of says you've completed a certain amount of learning and you are now authorized to paskin Jewish law. Okay? So smicha is absolutely a borrowed term. everyone uses it, I'm not going to make a big deal about it, but it is not the true, it is not the true Samicha. Okay? Jose, did you want to say anything?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the story. And again, maybe we'll give a share on the great Samicha controversy of the 1500s. Now, I was going to say that all of us who say we have Samicha,
what's that really?
We're frauds. We're liars. Okay. All right, so maybe we'll stop here. So right now, I'm actually in the middle of a long thought, but again, just to summarize where we are, the Meshech Chachma, again, we're trying to answer a big question. Why does the Torah refer to the day after Pesach, or Pesach rather, as Shabbos, when that's so prone to confusion based on the Tzdukim and the Karayim today? Let the Torah say, not Pesach, we'll give you a date. So we're starting off with the idea Rameir Simcha wants to say, that of all of the Mo'adim, Pesach is the closest to Shabbos. Now I'm going to leave the full development of that for next week, but so far we've identified two Nekudot that differentiate Yom Tov from Shabbos. Nekuda number one is Ochel Nefesh, which applies only to Yom Tov and not to Shabbos. Nekuda number two is on Shabbos we are not in charge of the holiness that we bring into the world. Hashem puts it in. On Yom Tov, the Kedushat Yom Tov depends on us. And even Bizman Hazah, when we don't have a Sanhedrin, it is only because Hillel Hasheni, the one who created the calendar, and his Sanhedrin sanctified all of the Rosh Chodeshim in advance until the year 6000. Now, very quickly, the Meshech Chachma says these two differences emanate from a third difference. And that is, Yom Tov is a celebration of Hashem's unique relationship to Am Yisrael. Without an Am Yisrael, there's no Pesach, there's no Shavuos, there's no Anonei HaKavod of Sukkot. So because Yom Tov is a celebration of us, Yom Tov is within our control. We control Yom Tov. Yom Tov bends to our Ochel Nefesh needs, and we are the ones who sanctify this month. Shabbos commemorates an ideal that intrinsically does not connect to us in our unique relationship to God. It celebrates God as the creator of the world. Hashem gave us a gift that we are the witnesses to that. But because Shabbos transcends the uniqueness of our relationship, we bend to Shabbos. Shabbos doesn't bend to us. We cannot cook on Shabbos for our needs. We don't control this man, because Shabbos is a transcendent idea that predated the Jewish people. So the two halachic differences between Yom Tov and Shabbos are based on the commonality that Yom Tov celebrates the uniqueness of our relationship to God, while Shabbos is a transcendental, universal idea. And that's why we bend to Shabbos as opposed to Yom Tov, which to some degree bends to us. Now, we'll see next week how this will pertain to Pesach, so I'll save that.
Yeah. How does Rosh Hashanah fit?
Ah, excellent. That's a very, very good question. Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, uniquely Jewish holidays. Yom Kippur is also uniquely Jewish because it commemorates the forgiveness for the Cheder Edel. Rosh Hashanah is a real problem. Rosh Hashanah, you're very hard-pressed to identify what is uniquely Jewish about Rosh Hashanah. It is a day of judgment. It's the day that God created Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon is humanity. It's not just the Jewish people. So we'll talk about it actually. It is, Rosh Hashanah is kind of the sore thumb that doesn't fit the pattern totally.